the Book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. We're going through the history of Israel. By that I mean the northern kingdom. The people of God are split into two countries, to the north, Israel, to the south, Judah, and 1 and 2 Kings focus particularly on the northern kingdom. And at the point we've reached, it sort of slows things down. There's a list, there's king after king, and they come and they go, and they're generally not very good. But then it sort of stops and it looks at two characters. The first is Elijah, the prophet, and the second is the king of Israel at that time, King Ahab. And it gives them essentially three chapters each. They obviously appear in each of the other sections, but three chapters each, and it gives them each a sort of a story arc, if you like. And the story of Elijah runs from chapters 17 to 19, and it starts with his first appearance as a prophet before King Ahab, and it ends with him appointing or calling his successor, Elisha. And those three chapters, it's one of those places where the chapter divisions do work, but that's how it should be, because you start off with chapter 17 and it's Elijah privately proving God's faithfulness. He publicly announces a drought and then he sort of disappears. And he has to trust God to provide for him and to guide him and to hide him from King Ahab, who wants to find him. And then chapter 18 is Elijah publicly proving God's lordship. You may know the chapter. It's Mount Carmel. It is God, Jehovah versus Baal, a public contest that ends with the Lord showing to all Israel who are gathered in front of them that he is God and Baal is not. And chapter 19, which we have before us, is Elijah privately struggling with God's purpose, but also learning that purpose. And we're not going to look at the whole chapter because there's just too much going on. We'll get down as far as verse 18. And I'll split it into three, and the first of those three points is about Elijah's struggle, and I'm thinking here of the first eight verses. So chapter 18 is this contest between the Lord and Baal, and the Lord wins beyond any debate. It's not like, well, it kind of looks like he's God. He is. There can be no doubt about it. And as that chapter concludes, there are some hints that maybe that will follow through into, well, national reformation. Ahab is not exactly enthusiastic for the Lord, but it seems he's willing to go along to an extent with Elijah. And it's looking good and progress seems to be made, and suddenly you run into Jezebel. And Jezebel is the queen. She is a Zidonian. She's a devotee of Baal. And she's a lot stronger character than her husband. Ahab, you can kind of does what the last person tells him to do. Jezebel knows her mind and does that. And so when she says in verse 2, well, essentially what she says is, you've got 24 hours to get out of Dodge or you're dead. She's not joking. She will kill Elijah if he doesn't clear out. And so he does, and he runs. He's going south. He goes through Israel. He goes through the nation of Judah. He gets to the south of Judah, to Beersheba. He goes beyond there. He gets to the wilderness. He sits down, and he asks God to let him die. Just end it. He is tired. He's scared. He is defeated. He is confused. He's in despair because this man has been hiding for 2 years, waiting for the moment when he can prove that God is God. And he's come out of God's direction and he's done that. And God has done something that's impossible and unthinkable. And yet then God hasn't done what seemed inevitable. It's like God did the difficult bit, but then didn't do the rest. You know, he sort of dribbled past the opposition's team and then missed an open goal. And the fruit of that victory is gone. And Israel is as much Baal as it ever was. And he just thinks, well, what was the point? I mean, you've got to be slightly careful about speculating about precisely what is in his mind, but it's quite clear he's not a happy bunny, is he, in verse 4. And his confusion and his sorrow are not entirely irrational, because as the passage goes on into verses 10 and 14, and he talks about Israel's apostasy, it's clear that he's being more rational there. And however bad he felt, the problem still remains. Israel are not going to follow the Lord. Christians get to feeling like Elijah sometimes, don't we? Sometimes we feel that all is lost. Sometimes we feel like a failure in the face of the world. Sometimes we just do not begin to understand what God is doing. Why does he give with one hand and then it seems take it away with the other? Sometimes the strains of living out faith to God in our circumstances just get too much. And we feel we can't bear it anymore. Well, what happened to Elijah, if we can learn something from that? And I'm conscious that if you're in that situation, then it's easy to say words, isn't it? And words are going to be pretty trite if you're genuinely despairing. And yet, there could be things here that could help people in that circumstance. What happens to Elijah? Well, firstly, notice he's still praying. He doesn't sit down and say, I'm going to end it all. He doesn't sit down and say, I want to end it all. He sits down and says to God, please end it all. He's actually still, in a very, very strange way, bringing his problems to the Lord, submitting himself to the Lord. And if we're in despair and confusion, we need to pray, don't we? Now, the reality is that what we pray in those circumstances probably won't stand up that well to objective scrutiny. When you're out of the moment and you look back and thinking, well, that wasn't the most theologically sound thing I could have said. That wasn't the wisest thing I've said. But sometimes confused, desperate petitions are what faith in action looks like, because that's all we can do. Strange, but so. We should do it because we have a God who knows how to deal with odd requests, who knows how to deal with things that we say, which are really just outbursts of emotion rather than strictly rational requests. You know, Paul in Romans talks about the Spirit helping people when we don't know what to pray. Interpreting signs. God knows what we're saying, why we're saying it. He's quite capable of saying no when he needs to say it. But it's good still to speak to him. And then notice that he experiences God's gentleness. He prays, let me die. That's not a good thing to pray. What does God say? Well, you shouldn't pray that. God says, arise and eat. Come on, you're tired. Come on, you need to build yourself up. You need this practical help. And there's a kindness in that, isn't there? There's a kind of common sense to it. There's a gentleness. God understands what behind the words. And yet notice also that when God provides for him, it's miraculous. An angel comes. By the way, there's the whole theme of eating and drinking in chapters 17 to 19. We don't have time to look into it, but this is part of that. Do you see the combination there is in God of practical gentleness and supernatural power? And there are times when we kind of need that, aren't there? And we need just practical help. And yet we need it in a way that only God can provide. And only God can do. Well, he does do that. And notice also that Elijah is still within God's wider plan. He eats, falls asleep again. The angel prods him again, and up he gets and eats some more. And says, you need to eat because you've got a journey to do. When it says in verse 7, the journey is too great for you, it's not talking about the journey he's just done. It's talking about the next stage of the journey. And so Elijah learns that actually, though he's run away in despair, he is still parts and within God's plan. In chapter 17 to 19, Elijah always moves when God tells him to, and only when God tells him to. Until he gets to verse 3 of chapter 19, and Jezebel threatens him and he runs. Which he was entitled to do. He wasn't advised to stand around and get martyred. But he's gone on his own initiative, and yet suddenly he finds that actually God is drawing him down to Mount Horeb. We may find that when we feel in a cul-de-sac, lost, confused, desperate, then we find that actually God is still working in our lives, and God is still planning, and God is still bringing us on his way that will lead us to where he would have us be. We may have done something like Elijah because we were desperate, because it seemed the right thing to do of our own initiative, and yet God was still in that and may still be in our struggles, in our debts. But as I said, easy to say, hard to do and live out, isn't it? And I understand that. But see in, if nothing else, in Elijah's struggles, how graciously and gently God deals with him and is willing to deal with you. But secondly, we have his encounter with the Lord in verses 9 to 18. And this is my second point, and it's seeking to unpack it, because if we're going to understand what God's point is in this passage, we just need to stop and notice some things about it. And the first thing we need to notice is that are the parallels between this passage and Moses appearing on Mount Sinai. Now, there are an awful lot of Old Testament references in this passage as a whole, and again, we don't have time to go into all of them, I'm afraid. But the key one is Moses on Mount Sinai, because Mount Horeb, where he ends up, is essentially Mount Sinai by another name. It's called Mount Horeb when the Lord appears in the burning bush. And when we see he goes 40 days and 40 nights in verse 8 in the strength of that food, we immediately think, don't we, of Moses, 40 days and 40 nights on the mount. And so he's back, if you like, where God met with Moses. In fact, when he, verse 9, when he goes into a cave, some people think that is the very cave in which Moses was hidden when God showed him his glory, which is one of those nice theories that you can't prove. But like Moses, it's an intensely personal experience. God is dealing with the man, But through the man, he's also dealing with the nation. After all, Moses went up on Mount Sinai to receive the law for Israel. And Elijah goes to Mount Horeb to receive God's words, as it turns out, about what he's going to do in the nation. So keep that parallel in mind, and if you spot others, well, they quite possibly are there. I can't mention them all. To unpack this encounter, you also need to see that the emphasis in verses 9 to 18 falls in verse 18. That's the bit that he particularly wants Elijah to notice and us to notice. And let me just explain why. There are two stages in what happens in verses 9 to 18, and they mirror each other. So stage one is verses 9 to 12. What happens in verses 9 to 12? Well, firstly, God asks a question. What are you doing here? It's not an accusation, by the way. It's like a teacher who knows the answer, getting their pupils to think it through for themselves. Getting Elijah to ask why it is that God has brought him here. So God asks a question. Elijah answers. It's not a wind, it's an accusation against Israel of apostasy. It's in verse 10. And then in response, in verse 11 and 12, God shows Elijah three dramatic events. There's a mystery about this because it says in verse 11, the Lord passed by, the wind comes, the rocks broke, but the Lord isn't in the wind. So the Lord passes by and yet he's not there. Is he there or is he not? I don't know. I don't quite know how that works. But the message is clear, isn't it? The wind, he's not in that. Nor is he in the earthquake. Nor is he in the fire. You notice, by the way, that two of those three things appeared in the previous chapter on Mount Carmel. God's not in those things. But then comes the end of verse 12, this still small voice, a thin, subdued sound. It may not even be articulate words. It seems to be external to Elijah. Now, I'm guessing that's the difference between that sound at the end of verse 12 and God's question in verse 9. So you see the pattern? Question, answer, three dramatic things, one rather more subtle thing which God is in. And verses 13 to 18 are the same pattern. You have the same question. You have the same answer. You have God announce three dramatic things. There's going to be a new king in Syria, Hazael. There's going to be a new king in Israel, Jehu. There's going to be a new prophet in Israel, Elisha. These are nation-altering, significant events. Remarkable events. I don't think a foreign king was anointed at any time prior to this date that I can recall in scripture anyway. But then comes the unimpressive or less impressive thing that actually in its way is more important. Judgment is coming, verse 17, but there are still 7,000 in Israel who haven't submitted to Baal. Do you see how that works? It's like a parable and then the explanation. Question, answer, three big things, final thing that matters. And then it's like God explains it. There's going to be three dramatic events coming. But remember that there are 7,000 who have not submitted to Baal. And notice briefly before we go on to my third point, which is to try and apply these things. Notice the movements of Elijah. In verse 9, where is he? He's in this cave. In verse 11, After question and answer, God tells him to go and stand outside the cave before the Lord on the mountain. And by implication, he does. But then the still small voice comes in verse 12. In verse 13, we're told he goes out and stands at the entering of the cave. So at some point, he's gone back in the cave. Yeah? He's seen the three great dramas, seen that God isn't in them, and it seems, and again, we have to be careful because it's not explained expressly, that he thought that was it. And then when he was back in the cave, he hears God speak. He's teaching him through timing there, isn't he? Teaching him patience through timing. I hope I was able to at least explain that in a way that makes sense. If not, I'll get a bit of paper and sketch it out afterwards. But what does it actually mean? And my third point is trying to apply that or this passage to us. Well, the point isn't that God wasn't in the great national events, nor is the point that Elijah's criticisms of Israel were wrong. In fact, they're basically right apart from one element. But Elijah, if you like, has overlooked what God has valued and seen. Elijah has looked at thousands who don't follow Baal, and God says, but I prize the 7,000 who don't. I prize the 7,000 who follow me. And so the application, I suppose, for us is see and understand what God is doing in our time and in our place. There are great events going on. There's an election coming. We've got to think about how we vote, if we vote. Prayerfully consider that, and there will be changes of some type or another. That's fine. God is in those things. We can trust God for those things. But above all, God looks at and sees and rejoices in those people that simply follow him. They were not vast numbers, but God knew. They are not people who are defined by any great success. In fact, they're defined in verse 18 in negative terms. They're people who haven't submitted to Baal. And it's like he's saying to Elijah, look, that you want to see me in action. That's me in action. Those people who still follow me. And so you and I, seeking to be faithful to God, and I speak to you as individuals and as a congregation, that's God at work in our time and in our place. That's what God sees and values and knows. And we're not to belittle that or overlook it, because it's God's work. I have left me 7,000. God has done it. God has kept a people. Ordinary, normal Israelites who still followed the Lord. So see, that's what God's doing. That's what he values. That's what he values in each age. And you know, people get forgotten and they pass, and yet God remembers. He knows you. He knows who sat in your pew before you. How long has this church been here? 325 years or something? They've all long since, most of those people being forgotten. People get forgotten so quickly, don't they? I mean, when I was prepping this, part of it, I used a Bible used by Peggy Flaxman. That some of that name you go, oh yes, I remember Peggy, but half of you probably have no idea who she was. She's passed on now, but she met here. She was one of God's people here. God endures, doesn't he? He knows who sat here before us. He knows who sits in your seat after you. And that should also humble us, shouldn't it? It's not an obvious way to encourage a despondent saint to take him up to a mountain and tell him, well, actually, I'm going to judge the nation, and by the way, please anoint your successor. But God does that. He's reminding him and he's reminding us that God endures. It's not Elijah's turn anymore. It's going to be Elisha's turn to serve God in his generation. And that's humbling, isn't it? It doesn't depend on Elijah. It doesn't depend on us. But it's also encouraging because God ensures his work goes on, that each generation has its 7,000 or however many it has. That God preserves them. The sword is coming in verse 17, but he says, I've kept myself some who will be safe. And it should encourage us to value one another. Elijah, the one part of the thing he says when God asks him a question, he responds. Most of it is right, but the thing he says, I only am left, for example, at the end of verse 14. And you can sort of see why he says that, because he's just literally been on his own on Mount Carmel with 850 prophets against him. But it's not actually right, is it? And God is saying that there are actually more of you than you realize. I've got 7,000, not just one, Elijah. And surely as part of that, God is saying to him, look, find some of those 7,000 because they will do you good. You can help them. They can help you. You can see that not all is lost. There are those that follow the Lord. And again, the application is there for us, isn't it? The benefit of one another. The benefit of even just seeing fellow Christians, knowing they exist, knowing they're still Christians, let alone actually speaking to them about Christian things. God calls us, doesn't he, to value and to draw strength from one another. You can see how God is teaching things that are eternal, and yet he's dealing still with this Elijah who is still struggling and sad with his own sense of failure. And he says that I have been working. I am working, and I will always have my people when you're gone. So he says to us that he's still working. He's still working through us if we seek to be those that are faithful to him. That's what he values. That's what he notices. That's what he loves. I just want to close by going to another parallel in this passage, because I've taken you to Moses and the Old Testament parallel, but what about New Testament? Well, there's an interesting parallel with the Apostle Paul, but we won't go down that particular line. What about Jesus? Well, you can think of the Mount of Transfiguration, that meeting of people who fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, because it's Moses and Elijah there with Jesus, isn't it? But what about Calvary? What about the cross? Well, let me put it like this. Elijah and Moses both went up mountains to meet with God, representing a people, and they represented an unworthy people. Whilst Moses was with God, Israel were building a golden calf and bowing down to that. Elijah complains with good reason that Israel are not following the Lord. Well, Jesus went to the Mount of Crucifixion, to Calvary, representing an unworthy people. He went to represent God, rejecters, sinners, people deserving judgment, worshippers of whatever is the equivalent of Baal in each person's heart, but not the Lord. Elijah went and complained of a sinful people and was told that the sword was coming in judgment. What happened with Jesus? Did that happen with Jesus? No, he went to the mountain to bear the judgment of the guilty, didn't he? He didn't say there's going to be a sword coming. In fact, scripture in Zechariah says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man, my fellow." Elijah came down knowing that judgment was coming. Jesus went bearing judgment for his people. How much better than Elijah is Jesus? How much more powerful? How much greater the work that he did as he went to meet God and bore the condemnation of the sins of his people from a justly angry God. Are you one of those for whom he died? He died for his people? You don't need to delve deep into the counsels of God to answer that question. It's believe and have. Believe on Jesus as representing you on that mountain and see him face judgment for sin. See him bear judgment for you. See how much greater than Elijah or Elisha or anyone else or Moses. Go lonely to a hill. He should be despairing, shouldn't he? You'd think, but he's not. Well, he's a man of sorrows, but he knows what he's going to do. He knows who he's going to save. And he goes up and takes the sword of the Lord on himself for us. You can thank God, can't we, for a better than a Moses and a better than Elijah, and trust in Christ to bear that judgment for us.